Our final speaker is Dr. Marguerite Lucia. She is a postdoctoral fellow at the Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing. She holds a BA from St. Olaf College, a BSN and MSN from Johns Hopkins School of Nursing, and an MPH from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Her research interests include understanding and addressing gender inequities in health, focusing on violence against women, and HIV prevention and treatment. She has also worked extensively in international settings, including Southeast Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Central America. Please give her a round of applause.
Thank you very much. I'm going to be stepping away a little bit from my norm of the overlap between HIV and IPV, and I'm going to be presenting today on the relationship between disordered eating and intimate partner violence among African American and African Caribbean women. So essentially I'm taking the tour of the world back, but through the Caribbean and back to Baltimore as well, as you'll see. First of all, I should say that I don't have any financial relationships to disclose in the past 12 months, actually probably ever. But before I begin, I'd really like to acknowledge the study participants for sharing the information that we gathered during the survey, as well as for the contributions of the African Caribbean African American Women's Health Study, the ACAWS research study team. And actually, one of my co-authors in this presentation, we had originally wanted her to present. She just graduated with her bachelor's, but she also just gave birth to a little baby boy 1 week ago, so here I am. Briefly, disordered eating patterns and eating disorders affect more than 8 million Americans today, and the majority of that is affecting women. In addition, disordered eating and eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any mental health-related problem. And to that end, the factors that influence disordered eating are beginning to be examined, but most of the research that has been done to date around disordered eating and eating disorders has primarily focused on Caucasian and college age samples. But part of the background that is important for this presentation particularly is that the connection between IPV and disordered eating, in that up to 26% of African American and African Caribbean women based on population-based studies have reported past year IPV. And with abused women, they are up to 5 times more likely to report disordered eating or eating disorders, depending on how it's been measured. But regardless, that additive risk is there. The second piece here is the relationship between depression and PTSD and disordered eating. Both are very highly prevalent. The exact relationship, though, when you add the third piece of IPV in there, has not really been examined extensively, and certainly not between in the population of African American and African Caribbean women. So to this end, we had 3 purposes of the study. The first one was to examine whether IPV experiences, particularly focused on physical and sexual violence, depression, and PTSD, whether they're actually associated with disordered eating patterns. The second one was to examine whether the type of IPV or risk for lethality from partner abuse connotes an additional risk. And then to examine whether depression actually mediates that relationship between IPV and DE, in that there is whether that pathway exists and whether it is a partial mediation or whether it's a full mediation. For the study, we conducted a multi-site mixed methods comparative case control study in Baltimore, Maryland, and also in St. Thomas and St. Croix, the U.S. Virgin Islands. We gathered quantitative data between 2009 and 2011, and we are currently conducting qualitative interviews that will help us sort of fill out some of the contextual relationships that we see. The women who were The sample that we had were African-American women and African-Caribbean women, so women who self-identified as being some aspect of either African-American or African-Caribbean. Some women identified as being black and with Hispanic descent combined, but we included all of them as well. And they had to be over 18 and less than 55 years old. And we recruited them from primary care, prenatal, and family planning clinics. We did require that they were in an intimate relationship in the past 2 years. And so of the 1,231 eligible women, there were 394 unselected controls. And we ended with a total sample of 832 women. Of these women, the complete data for the variables of interest were collected on 784 women. So that was the final sample of the entire group. And we had IRB approval from Johns Hopkins University as well as the University of the Virgin Islands. As I said, we recruited them in person from waiting rooms in different clinics in Baltimore and U.S. Virgin Islands. But once the women were recruited into the study, then they took an audio computer-assisted self-interview via a laptop computer. And this was a fantastic method to use, partly because many of the questions that we were asking were very sensitive. And it's been shown that being able to answer to a computer is a little bit less invasive, so to speak, than answering to a face-to-face interview. In addition, we had measures in the survey itself that measured risk for lethality. We used the danger assessment. And the computer, we had programmed it to flag if a woman reached that threshold or surpassed that threshold of severe violence, that the computer would let us know, and we could then address that at the end of the interview. In addition, it would flag us if the woman had responded that she was either at risk for or had, you know, suicidal ideations. The main outcome variable was disordered eating, and that was dichotomized on self-report in that we asked the question, how often have you had, and we called it an eating disorder because we didn't want to get into, we wanted to use terms that would be somewhat familiar, but how often have you had an eating disorder, either overeating or undereating, in the past year? And while that's not meeting DSM criteria, we weren't trying to diagnose an eating disorder, but really just see patterns of disordered eating. Predictor variables for the entire sample included sociodemographics, such as age, education, income, insurance. We also looked at children living in the house under the age of 18, and marital status. And also we looked at site location, and the site location actually ended up, I'm getting ahead of myself here a little bit, but the site location didn't actually have a significant relationship with the disordered eating, but it did have some significant relationships with some of the other predictors. So as I said down on the bottom, we used generalized linear mixed models, which included the random effects for site-to-site variability. But going back up, we also used predictor variables, including depression. Well, it was more depressive symptoms using the CESD-10, and those women who met the threshold for depressive symptoms, as well as a PTSD survey that was 4 questions long, and anybody who scored above a 3 on that, it has been shown to that they are reflective of having PTSD. Again, not diagnostic. And then IPV, we used a series of measures, including the abuse assessment screen, the women's experience of battering, but then we also used the sexual violence against women, the SVAS, which measured both physical and sexual violence. And then, like I said, we used the danger assessment screen as well. And that brings me to the additional predictors for the physical and sexual IPV cases, in that we looked at the type of IPV, being initially we looked to see if there were the categories of physical, sexual, and physical and sexual, but no one reported just sexual, so we just used physical and sexual. And the risk for lethality was, again, using the danger assessment. The representative in our sample, 47% came from Baltimore of the entire sample, 29% from St. Thomas, and 24% from St. Croix. The average age was 28.7 years, with a range, like I said, of 18 to 55. There were 43% who were partnered or married, and 47% were employed. But in the overall sample, the prevalence of disordered eating was 6.5%, which is actually fairly representative or representative of the percentage and the prevalence that has been shown in some other studies, not focusing solely on African American and African Caribbean women. 46% had mild to severe depressive symptoms, and 13% met the cut point for post-traumatic stress disorder. Among abused women, again, physical and sexual included, there were 401 women. And physical only represented 37%. And physical and sexual represented 63%. The prevalence of disordered eating among that group was 11%. And 56% showed mild to severe depressive symptoms. And 21% met the cut point for PTSD. These were all significantly different if you looked across the sample. The results for the full sample, when we control, so we first did just unadjusted odds ratio, and you can see there are some wide confidence intervals, but those are most likely related to the fact that disordered eating was only 6% in the group that we were looking at. But regardless, IPV was significantly associated with disordered eating, as was both the, that's a little bit off, but it's the mild and the severe depressive symptoms were significant in the unadjusted. In addition, excuse me, PTSD was also significant. In the adjusted OR, you see that actually both IPV and the depressive symptoms remain significant. IPV does decrease somewhat, but women are still five times more likely to experience or to report DE than those not abused. PTSD, however, becomes non-significant. When we looked specifically at the correlates of DE among cases only, we found that although some were significant in the unadjusted odds ratio, really only depression maintained its significance in the final model when controlling for age, marital status, employment status, and education, in addition to the other correlates. One of the main points demonstrated in the study is that race is actually not a protective factor, as has been purported previously, and that the prevalence of DE is comparable to other studies that were not focusing in African American and African Caribbean women. This is of importance for those of us who are healthcare providers, that we're not automatically discounting that DE can be affecting all races, and that one race is not more influenced than others. Oops, sorry. IPV does confer an additional risk for disordered eating. The actual rationale behind that is still unclear, and that's one of the things that we're looking at in our qualitative data, in that it may be a mechanism to cope with the chronic stress or a perceived lack of control in the relationship. In addition, we did do analysis. Sorry, I have a little bit of a cold. To look at mediation, and it was partially mediated in that adjusted model. The severity of IPV was interestingly fully mediated by depressive symptoms in these women who were experiencing abuse. There were limitations, as I briefly mentioned earlier, that the relatively low prevalence of DE did result in these wide confidence intervals, and unfortunately for the mixed effects models that we were using, there was not in a way to address correct for those wide confidence intervals. However, also there was the other limitation that disordered eating was dichotomized from one question. It would be nice to have a few more questions in there to assess the extent, as well as determining whether it's overeating or undereating, but they were lumped in together. This study was one of the first ones that looked specifically at African American and African Caribbean women instead of college samples. And the other strength, as I mentioned, was that we used ACASI, which allowed for more reporting of certain sensitive topics. I mentioned them. As clinicians and practitioners, we do need to identify unique stressors such as IPV and depression that can put women at risk for DE. It's very important that I'm a nurse, and so it's very important in my clinical practice that I'm paying attention to these type of things and realizing that there is some connectivity, and it's not just in the healthcare field, but also in advocacy field, that women who are presenting positive for IPV, that we're also considering these other pieces, or if they're presenting in a mental health capacity, that the mental health practitioners are considering these other pieces that can influence. And so understanding these risk factors can enhance prevention efforts, including the intervening and referral early on for mental health resources, and also for the assessment of disordered eating to incorporate an assessment for IPV and depression, because these pieces are so interrelated. And I apologize for the coughing effect.
Okay, at this time we're about to begin the question and answer portion. I will ask that you remember to direct your question to the appropriate speaker, and I will acknowledge you in order so we can get started. If anyone has questions.
HHI has done work with militia members in New York City, so members of rebel groups who talk about what it's like to be a man in a rebel group. And what you hear over and over again, and this is echoed by some other work done with the National Army, is that men feel extraordinarily dehumanized, demasculated, and have this deep kind of sense of disrespect and disrespect for human life and a need to assert control. You know, very, very classical gender theory in some ways. But what we also see is that young men growing up in DRC in what is a decades-long conflict also have those feelings even though they aren't technically armed combatants. And we see very high levels of IPV, which are unfortunately often occluded because of the conversations about conflict-related sexual violence, but as you all know, it's not a dichotomy, it's actually a continuum, because we have armed actors who are demobilizing, who come home and perpetrate violence against their wives and sisters. So it's an extraordinary complex place, and I will say that it's not a zero-sum game. So doing work with only women or only men shouldn't take away from doing work with the other side of the issue. And that what we do see in DRC, the reality is women's lives are mediated by the male head of household. That is just a reality, and we can work to change it, but really effective programming is going to involve that man. It's going to involve the husband or the father or the uncle who is controlling the woman's experience. And I think the most effective programming has to take that into account no matter what, but it is very complex.
This is also compelling. I was wondering if your studies are looking also at perhaps suicide in the comparison of in suicide in women and in men, both in the rejected and in the non-rejected groups. I know it's another big thing to ask, but I was wondering if there's, you know, sort of this impact of survivorship.
Yeah, and I think we see really low suicidality in DRC compared to where you would expect it to be higher. And there's some really interesting work done after Hurricane Katrina nationally that showed lower rates of suicidality among those who had experienced really intense trauma, because I think this survivorship kicks in somehow. We tread really delicate ground, because while we work with these amazing social workers and mental health professionals, there's such poor services in DRC, and so it's always this question of, do you ask about suicidal ideation and then not really have the opportunity to engage with that? But we have included a PTSD questionnaire as part of the survey. And the truth is, to be perfectly honest, this is a bit of dirty laundry, I don't know how helpful it was to include, because people score off the chart. So basically we're getting 90% positivity.
Yeah,
on
just looking there.
Right. No, thanks. I think I planted that in you unintentionally. But I do think it's an interesting question, because there's a lot of attention being given to this question of pregnancy intendedness and wantedness, and they often get conflated so that it's just all the same thing, but the measurements really are flawed. I mean, it's a large demographic and health survey, so it can't capture everything. But essentially the way that you're able to measure through the DHS is through a series of questions in which they ask women who've been pregnant in the last 5 years about each pregnancy, and at the time you became pregnant, did you want to become pregnant then? Did you want to wait, or did you not want to at all? So you can see that you're already limiting, right? The further limitation is that they're asking about live births and child by name. So it would be, you know, let's say Marguerite is my child. They ask, at the time Marguerite was born, did you want to become pregnant then, later, or not at all? And she's running around the house. So I think, you know, there's also been another separate but very linked body of work looking at this question of measuring intendedness and wantedness for live births, because obviously it's skewed. If I never had that child, whether I had an abortion or a miscarriage or whatever, it's a very different response than perhaps this live child in front of me. So I think, you know, we're able to capture it, but the bottom line would be that it's probably, not capturing the true number of unintended or unwanted pregnancies, especially in places like Jordan, where it's limited, but you are theoretically able to get an abortion, then you're going to miss a whole number of pregnancies that were not carried to term and resulting in live births that were probably more linked with the violence. Thanks.
My question was for I think both the first two presentations, with the France data in Maryland and then the DHS data in Jordan, and I apologize if I missed them. I was curious about if you had the chance to look at, or if there's other research looking at birth outcomes around the birth weight or preterm birth and interpersonal
families. So for the PRAMS data set, Dr. Diana Cheng, who I worked with on this analysis, had previously looked at the association between intimate partner violence and low birth weight, but they did not find an association. In some of the other states, I think maybe Saltzman, I'm not sure exactly who published the paper, but in some of the other states where the PRAMS data was collected, they did find an association between intimate partner violence and low birth weight, but the association was not statistically significant in the Maryland data set.
And I can say that for the Jordan research, I didn't look at low birth weight as an outcome, but in some other research that I'm doing with WHO, that is actually the exact question. I mentioned the Global Burden of Disease report. So one of the health risk factors that we're, or sorry, one of the health outcomes we're looking at with IPV is low birth weight, among a lot of others. And so it's a meta-analysis there using whatever evidence we were able to find globally. So some, we do include some PRAMs. There's, as you would expect, there's more data coming from places like Australia and the U.S. than the developing world, but we have that too. And I don't remember the exact number of studies at the moment, but statistically significant findings showing that women who've experienced IPV do have a greater risk for having a low birth weight, and they're usually, the data are collected with women about an index pregnancy, so the violence during that pregnancy and the outcome, so it's a really strong association that we're able to show.
For the last speaker, your instrument that you made, could it differentiate that the eating disorder followed the violence, or the violence followed the eating disorder? The eating disorders, was there any way of establishing the causality, perhaps with one as opposed to the other?
Well, it was a cross-sectional survey, so, you know, solidly defining that, not necessarily. However, the question for the disordered eating was in the past year. And the violence, there were questions that were in the past 2 years or lifetime. So women who were reporting, there were some women who reported lifetime. The majority of women reported in the past 2 years, but it's not entirely clear as to whether the violence occurred in the last year, you know, which one came first. But within the past 2 year, you know, there's likelihood that violence actually, because they were asked to talk about the partner who was violent to them, and when the abuse started, and when the abuse ended, and so we're able to, and that's requiring further analysis to really look in to see whether that abuse started two years or prior, and then we can develop a little bit more of a sense of the causality, given that the disordered eating is just in the past year. But that's a very good question. Thank you.
I had a question for the first presenter with the PRAMS data. I know we often have like a much broader definition of intimate partner violence, and then typically what actually gets reported or measured, even though PRAMS asks other questions, is just looking at physical violence. But I was wondering if you had a chance to look at any of the other forms of violence to see if they were perhaps even, you know, shifting, and perhaps during pregnancy, maybe they weren't physically abused, but switched to other forms of violence that wouldn't physically show up when the woman went to the exam room.
Yeah, thank you. I actually thought someone would be interested in that, and it's supposed to be my extra slide. I'm not sure how to get back into the system. There were 47.1 versus 1.9% of women. That's those who reported, well, since you're interested only in emotional and sexual abuse, I don't have the exact percentage of those who reported emotional abuse. What I do have is the proportion who reported emotional abuse who presented late versus those who presented early. So 47.1% who reported emotional abuse presented late to prenatal care, and 1.9% of those who reported emotional abuse presented late to who did not report emotional abuse presented late. So those who presented late were more likely to report emotional abuse, 47% to 2%. And regarding sexual abuse as well, those who reported sexual abuse were more likely to present late to prenatal care, 12.6% versus 1.1%. But they were highly correlated, and so we couldn't really put them in the same model. So it seems like just about everyone who reported physical abuse also had In fact, 100% of those who reported physical abuse also reported emotional or sexual, or both emotional and sexual abuse. So they tend to occur together, which is what literature, the body of existing literature says. Does that address what you're interested in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the controlling behavior of the partner as well. So those who reported that their partner had controlling behavior were more likely to present late for prenatal care. That's 33.5% against 3.2% who did not have, who did not present late. I mean, whose partners did not have controlling behavior, so, yeah.
One question quickly about, I was just so interested about the hypothesis behind the increased family planning associated, which to me is also a bit counterintuitive.
Right.
And then a quick question from Marguerite, which was, there was a quote from a woman who took the survey, and I was, you know, this great quote, and I was wondering if there was a qualitative piece built in or if that had been recorded at some point during the computer system survey or where the quote had come from. I thought there was a quote from a woman who was talking about, you know, when I present, you know, if a woman has bruises, it's better to ask because she doesn't want to volunteer. Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize.
So women were asked, I'm sorry, women were asked to, there's a section in the PRAMS data where women are asked to put any additional comments.
Okay.
And so that quote was from that section. They have used them, they just use them for different presentations because it's not structured and it's just a woman having more to say than the questionnaire has asked from her. So we just pull those quotes for whatever presentation it appears to be useful for. So no qualitative study has been done to pull all of those together because they're so diverse. It's just what else is on your mind apart from what we've asked you.
And the question about exposure to violence and current use. As I said, I expected that women who had experienced violence would be less likely to be current users, and I think that's really coming from this view of power parity, right? So her husband is controlling, and so therefore she doesn't have access or the autonomy to make decisions about accessing family planning. And there's a lot of literature that shows that, specifically in the developing world, I think in, you know, patriarchal societies, you see it a lot in India. There's so much data coming out of India. On the flip side, though, there's some data coming from the U.S. and Canada and Australia that shows the opposite, that women who are in coercive or violent relationships are so motivated to do anything to prevent having a child with that partner. So it's, you know, it's sort of that idea that, okay, maybe I'm stuck being married to him, but I don't want him to be the father of my children, or I don't want another one now. And so they're highly motivated to prevent it. So that's probably more what we're seeing in the Jordan data. Yeah.
Well, this concludes our session. I'd like to thank each one of the speakers for sharing their information with us today, and I'd like to thank all of the attendants for taking part in the session. I hope that everyone learned as much as I have about health issues involving intimate partner violence, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your time while at the convention. Thanks for coming.